Good evening or afternoon. At any point in the presentation, feel free to ask us questions with hashtag GoForth, and we'll get to them towards the end of the presentation. But for now, I want to tell you a little story. It's about a young girl. When I was 4 years old, I wore my Wonder Woman underoos everywhere. I wore them in my house, in my grandparents' house, in the neighbor's house, and in the yard. And it's a good thing that I remember this very clearly, because there are no photos of this to actually prove that this happened. So thanks, Mom and Dad, for being the kind of parents that don't take pictures of their kids running around in their underwear. But seriously, there's no proof. But thank goodness we have the internet to save us, because other parents at the same time were taking similar pictures. Like this person's parents. How awesome, right? They have like the golden cuff and like the crown and the golden lasso of truth. This is truly awesomeness. And when I was 4, I really wanted to go to superhero school. But I was like, what? It doesn't exist? You mean I'm going to have to go to school with the other kids learning their ABCs and 1, 2, 3s? I'm going to have to ride the school bus? And I'm not going to be able to save the world from looming evil? What? So, what's an aspiring superhero to do, right? So at a very young age, you know, from the time I was born, yeah, that's not a puppet, that was me at age like 0 plus 1. I've always been a learner and a maker, a designer. You guys have those like that too, I'm sure. A creative, a connector, and a doer. Even when doing for me meant a lot of extra doing for my parents. And through all this time, I continued to learn and grow. I had lots of client work. My first client was when I was 14. I don't know how this happened, but I had a teacher who had a friend who worked for NASA. And they said, well, can you do this newsletter? And I was like, okay. So, you know, I fire up PageMaker. And I worked on a newsletter. And looking back on it now, it's totally desktop publishing. It's not real graphic design. But that was a cool experience at 14. And I was really fortunate because my parents were into the whole idea of design. They had some friends that did it. They helped me to go to shadow them. And they even let me go to art college without freaking out about me like being poor on the street. So my parents are pretty cool. So I worked for different companies, public relations, marketing, and printing presses too. So I have a very varied past. And at one point I started my own business. And then at one point within that business, I was asked to do all of the graphic design for a Nicole Kidman and Daniel Craig movie called The Invasion. And so for this movie, I did 600 graphics in a matter of a couple of months. Everything from that little sign behind her, it says, take the step, that movie. Anyone see that? Yeah, right? The graphics were awesome. Everything from these big signs to these little teeny things that were holding and their name badges and everything, and then to these big street signs. And sometimes they were on screen and sometimes they weren't, but they helped create a sense of place. And I was doing this, and I was doing it well, and I was on call for graphic design 24 hours a day. And in my own way, I was doing my superhero thing, you know, punching through work at 102 degree fever. I figured I could do it. But what I realized is that I really still wanted to save the world. And I was like, well, what can I do? I'm being asked to do more films. I could go in this way that seems pretty lucrative and pretty exciting and sort of sexy, right? And then I said, I want to teach. People thought, you're crazy, Leslie, you're crazy. And I was like, yeah, that's kind of my life theme. But what I realized, because I teach at the university level, I teach at University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, I teach at a state college. It's not an art college. It doesn't seem sexy, but it's really cool. Because I get to work with these students, and we get to focus on things that are not just line and color, shape and form, and not just about having a constructive critique, but it's about community and community in the classroom. We do community through a lot of things, like eating. We do a lot of that in my classrooms. And even having type cupcakes. There's actually a key on those, and so you could choose which type cupcake you want. And I realized all of this is a part of this learning journey. And my father, this is, I love that hat. So this is my mom and dad and sister, and that's me with like a scrunched face. But my dad always says, I want to be learning. When I think I know it all, I might as well be dead. Because it is the journey of learning that makes living worthwhile. So my journey has been kind of interesting, and I've taken different paths, and I've taken big risks, and I've loved it along the way. For me, it's been awesome. And some of the things that I've been able to do while teaching are things like writing. So I've been able to write for Alyssa Part, thanks Jeffrey, and for things like .NET Magazine, and co-author a book and be the creative director of the book Interact with Web Standards that actually helps learners learn standards and web design and web development. I've been able to do things like exhibit work and take work. This is HTML. What happens when you take HTML and put it up on a chalkboard and use chalkboard pencils and paint and everything to write it out? It's a totally different experience of the medium we're so used to working in. I've had the opportunity to speak all over the world about things like the web and teaching it. And I've realized through this journey that the more excited I get, the higher my right eyebrow raises. So if you look the internet, you will see me a lot like this. And my eyebrow is like this, because I'm really excited about the things that I get to talk about. And that's because I like to interact with people. And Interact is one of these things that we created from the Web Standards Project Education Task Force. It was going to be called the Web Standards Education Task Force something something curriculum. And we're like, wait, let's make this little design thinking. And it became Interact. And the idea of acting, the idea of connecting education and industry is something that I see as part of my theme, as part of what helps me to make awesomeness. So I've gotten the opportunity to work on curriculum. And if you're a professor or an educator or learning, this is a great way to get involved with the web. And we're very fortunate that the W3C has given a little bit of new life into this initiative. We've had the book Interact with Web Standards. And all of these things still interacting. And I like to try to make web design education sexy. Anyone ever try to make education sexy? Anyone? No. It's a tough thing. So we called it We Rock for Web Education Rocks. And created this amazing event that was both a tour and a summit, something we brought 13 people from Adobe and Opera and all these people onto a riverboat. Let me tell you, if you want people to have a good time when planning intensively, have the meeting in the bar with windows all around. Now, maybe hold the drinks to 4 or 5 or maybe 3, but, you know, it's great to bring people together, and we did this on the Chattanooga River. And we had a full schedule of different ways that we could help try to figure out the challenges of web education. And then one of the most important things we did was have a public-facing event. An event that had 250 people attend. And we're talking, Chattanooga's not the biggest city. I mean, we've got the fastest internet in the Northern Hemisphere right now. You might be asking how that happened. Look up like hashtag gig tank and you'll find out a lot of information. But we've got a lot of interest in web education and a lot of interest in web and entrepreneur spirit in Chattanooga. And so we had people that were like ceramists coming in. We had people coming in from Alabama and Georgia, all here to ask questions like, who wants to be a mediocre teacher? And how can we connect with the industry? We had our state senators come in and state councilmen. We had students. We had community all together. And what I've noticed looking back at the themes through what I've done is that a lot of them are design and design related. They're design thinking. They're design thinking to the problem challenges. And when I think about the other themes that create what I call my map for awesomeness, what my, you know, superhero code of conduct, when I think about the 4 P's of passion, which is pure energy, and purpose, which is the meaning why we do things, and promise, our commitment to the world, to others, and to ourselves, and then our pursuit, our actions that we take, I do see a common theme. And if I were wearing a golden lasso of truth, which I am today, yes, every girl needs a little sparkle. My map for awesomeness, my passion, purpose, promise, and pursuit, we kind of go like this. And this is one specific example. My passion is the future of education, specifically web and design education. My purpose is I want to connect community, academia, and industry. My promise is to make awesomeness and do good. It's a really easy one to wake up in the morning and feel happy and proud about. It's one to go to sleep at night and feel just like at ease. And my pursuit, the one I'm going to show you right now, is something I did with my junior level graphic design students. It's an undergraduate program within a class called Professional Practice in Graphic Design. And this is called Create-A-Thon on Campus. It was a 24-hour work around the clock. It was a creative blitz. It's kind of, anyone do a hackathon or something like that? I see some hands. So it's like that, except for class, and it was 24 hours straight. We didn't sleep. It was way more time than that, actually. We had 34 students from UTC participate. We had 45 professionals who did not sleep at all to help support UTC students. And we were all working together in the service of 320 Dalewood Middle School students. And these Dalewood Middle School students, they don't have the easiest life. They're 15 minutes away from the university, but their eighth graders are reading at second grade level. We've got 95% of these students at Dalewood who are like beautiful, wonderful kids. 95% of them are free or reduced lunch, meaning they need government assistance to just make sure they have one or two meals a day. And 50% of the students are in foster care, so there's not really that stable home life. And what we learned there is 80% of the students that were at this pep rally that we were helping to kind of use design thinking and our energy as professionals and college students and professors to kind of give a sense of purpose and pride and help have a sense of, you know, meaning within education. We realized 80% of them in that audience were not going to graduate high school. That's a scary thought, and this energized all of us. When we were walking through the hallways of Dalewood Middle School, we wondered, where is hope? And then we would look at the students' faces, and we would realize where it is. We would realize that there were superheroes, and they were everywhere. There were superheroes in the principal who, during the pep rally, took time to talk to one individual student. There's superheroes who are the art teachers at the school who, when asked, what can you do, respond, see your light. There are the college students, and this is a wall. She's standing up against it because that's all the sleep she was going to get. And the superheroes are professionals. They're all of us in this room that interact, that connect, that make meaning with the next generation of creatives, right? The next generation of web developers in service to the greater good of our community. And talking about community, we have community members that get involved. And when we as professionals get excited about things, it happens, it goes both ways. Community members help get involved, and we have students getting involved, and it's really exciting. We also realized that the superheroes were the middle school students who stood with great pride, who wanted to make a difference in their own school. So yeah, we created branding, and we created new learning programs, and we got DJs into the school. Like, we did all kinds of cool things. But what the most important thing, I believe, was creating that connection between the different levels of people. Because we all put on the same shirts that day that said, I can. We all showed up to work, and we were all equal. And part of this, I want to show you a quick video. My students put together, they never videotaped anything or put together, cut any video at all. And this is what they came up with, kind of showing the pep rally. I believe all of us have a map for awesomeness to follow. And if we listen to our passion and our purpose, make a promise, and then pursue it, we can really live lives that are filled with happiness and joy and connectivity. And it doesn't matter if you're a web designer, a web developer, a writer, a marketer, whatever. We all have opportunities to give back, to connect, and to, you know, make some awesomeness. So I kind of believe it's really important for us to all share our stories. You know, thank you for letting me share mine. Comics share stories, and we should too. So I encourage you, as you're walking through the next couple of days at South By, to share your stories of awesomeness and to embrace each other, to support each other, to find ways to take our industry to the next level, to bring up our student body, to connect with each other, to do some positive good things. And so I've shared my story. Now I'd like Jeffrey to share his about how he goes forth and makes awesomeness. Thank you.
Thanks, Leslie. Thanks, Leslie. Can you hear me? Is Alec Pollock here? Alec, I see you back there. Could you stand, please? And Donald Buckley, could you stand, please? Okay. So, first of all, I wouldn't be here without these two gentlemen. Alec was my partner on my first website, batmanforever.com, and Don was our partner and creative lead on the project. Basically, Don went to the ad agency where we worked and said, you guys know how to make websites, and we lied and said yes. So, and that's how we got here. That's probably how everyone, I think we all got started by lying and saying yes, right? Am I right? So that's really, go forth and make awesomeness. Thank you, guys. I like Leslie's four P's. They're very exciting. I have slightly different motivations. I'm a really petty man and resentful of others. I think it's because I'm short, or it could be five. There could be, I could tell you at least five things I'm insecure about, but I don't really need to do that here. I pay someone else to listen to that. The main thing is, a lot of some of my motivations are very positive and lovely and spiritual, and others are just mean. But whatever works, it's really important that whatever works, that's what you grab hold of. This is Pardon My Icons, which I did in 1995. I don't know if anyone remembers this. If you do, go, yeah. Cool. So here was the motivation. I had just started designing websites, and they were ugly. Not only were mine ugly, all websites were ugly. And there were these icons that people were, you'd go to some like user group or some forum, and there'd be these really terrible, like dripping blood, a cat jumping, the guy with the shovel, remember that stuff? And you were supposed to use those. And like a lot of people who were self-taught designers or self-taught HTML wranglers were using this ugly crap. And I thought, well, I can do better than that. Right? Okay, so I want it. So the positive motivation was, I want to make the web pretty. And the negative motivation was, I can do better than that. And either they both worked. I made this stuff. I had no idea it would catch on, but it really did. And I can't really show it to you because I'm sure there's like 5,000 copyright violations in this set of icons. Because although I'd been working in advertising for some time, I didn't realize that you can't just copy an Andy Warhol and call it your icon that you made. This is the ad graveyard, and how I got to make this awesomeness was totally resentment. I'd been working in advertising, and I could never sell a good ad, right? Has anyone ever worked in advertising? Is anyone still in advertising? Okay. I worked at one place where I was part of the team that was brought out when the client was dissatisfied to scare the client back into buying the mediocrity. The client would go, you guys just keep selling us this safe, boring crap. Can't you do it? And they'd say, well, Zeldman and his partner have a campaign. Perhaps you'd like to see that. And they'd go, oh, no. And so then they'd very happily buy the, you know, the happy red lobster or whatever it was. So this was an ad. I'm sure you can't see it, especially in the back, but it's a picture of, so the Beatles, there was going to be ABC had commissioned the three, somehow ABC had wrangled the three surviving Beatles to come together and perform. And we were trying to, my partner Steve McCarron and I were trying to convince ABC to call it the Beatles Reunion, which for many legal reasons they weren't going to do, and the Beatles weren't going to agree to it. And there's lots of stuff that was way beyond our control. But one nice thing about being creative is that you're arrogant and you think your idea is good, so you should just make it happen somehow. We weren't able to sell it, but in our rage, we did this ad, which, and I'm a big John Lennon fan, so I'm sorry in advance, but the headline is, they said it would take three more bullets, the Beatles reunion. So, And this was an ad we couldn't sell. And I had lots of ads I couldn't sell, strangely enough. And what the client ended up buying was like a picture of a classic picture of the Beatles with the headline, "Here Comes the Sun." Right? So, like, how inspiring is it to work on stuff like the Beatles and then the client buys that? That's sad. So in my lust for vengeance, I created the advertising graveyard. And this was a place where real ads that someone had tried to sell, probably for good reason, hadn't run, would be placed. And I just threw it out there. It's like 1995. Again, thinking, I don't know, there weren't very many people on the web. But because of that first website, that very lucky break, batmanforever.com, where there were 3 million people using the internet, using the web, and 1.5 million people visited the site, I had this inflated, grandiose sense that I could put anything out there and I'd get 500,000 people to look at it. So that was not true, but it was true. If you put enough stuff out there, people would find it, right? What's the Kevin Costner thing? If you build it, they will come, et cetera. You know, if you build it with good HTML tables back then, they will come. Okay. And then this is the Daily Report. This is a blog. I called it writing, but when I started, because my first experience was for Warner Brothers and BatmanForever.com, I thought the web was still a very much a broadcast thing, and you had to, like any other art form, you don't just come out and say who you are and what's going on with you. You create this illusion to entertain other people, and you sort of mask who you are. So, you know, I had like the ad graveyard and all these kinds of things that were supposed to be entertainments. And after a while, I started putting up almost like in the front of a traditional magazine, like the New Yorker, they'll say in the current issue, we got this writer to do such and such. Thinking like an entertainer, I would start talking about what I was doing on the site that week or that day. And I started stretching and talking about what other people were doing on their sites too. And I thought it was really unimportant, the least important thing I was doing. And as a result, that empowered me to do it, to be prolific and successful. If I had thought for a minute that people were actually reading the Daily Report, this early proto-blog, I would have worried so much about the content and worried so much about the writing that I never would have become a blogger, right? But because I figured nobody was paying attention anyway, and the blog, which wasn't called that then, was the least important thing I was doing, I thought, like, the ad graveyard is the important, exciting thing, and this is just some nonsense. Because I didn't care about it, I was able to, like, crank it out all the time, which, really, I could have been in marketing or PR. So the blog evolved. This is the famous HTML fist. And when XHTML came out, I made one with an extra finger, which I can't find anymore, which is sad. And then there's the HTML5 fist, which also has an extra finger. And it evolved and evolved, and I sort of, blogging sort of evolved and became this thing. And after I'd been blogging for about 10 years, they started calling it blogging, and there were books sent to me by people who had just been blogging for 6 months to tell me how I was doing it wrong. I was doing everything wrong. I'd been doing it wrong all that time. So that was good. But that just made me more set in my ways. Again, because for me, resentment is an excellent motivator and competitiveness is an excellent motivator. This is My Glamorous Life. Did anyone ever read this? Thank you, both of you, very much. So I have a friend, Derek Pawazik, who we became friends over the internet, and he created this awesome site called Frey.com. Does anyone remember that? Okay, so Frey.com, yeah, you can clap for it. It's very good. It's awesomeness. Frey.com was a personal storytelling site. And again, from my background, personal storytelling seemed really weird. Like, why would you talk about yourself? If you're a writer, you're supposed to be Charles Dickens or Dashiell Hammett or something. You might draw from your experience, but you're not really supposed to talk about yourself. Why would you do that? Nobody cares. Like, you know, everybody's talking about their, you know, I ate a cheese sandwich today. Who cares? But Derek made it an art form. He made personal, I don't know whether he was an artist or a narcissist, but he made Frey.com, and it was an art form, and he did all kinds of really super cool stuff with early web design. Like, he used frames to make curtains that you'd part, right, to read a piece about the theater. He was doing art direction on a per-story basis It was amazing and really inspiring. And I didn't even attempt to do that, but I did feel empowered to start writing about myself. I think the first story I wrote was about going to a bank machine and it ate my card. And then the lady behind me went to use it. And I said, "Ma'am, you don't want to use that. It's eating cards." And she just shrugged and stuck her card in and got her money and said, "Worked for me." And that made me feel, that filled me with rage. So I started writing. It's a really good motivator, I'm sorry to say. Nobody will like me after this, but this is really the truth. Like, a lot of this was just like the kind of anger that would make you a really boring guy, like at a bar or in a bowling alley complaining. "You know what they did? You know what she said? That bitch? I'll tell you." You know, that would be awful. But if you put it in prose and put it on the internet, it's art, right? So that's my glamorous life. And September 11th, I had just fallen in love with a woman who was married to someone else. She'd just left her husband. I had just left my girlfriend. My girlfriend was living in my apartment. It was like Downton Abbey, only in the 2000s. There was all this drama going on, all this romantic, crazy drama going on. And then Osama bin Laden sent terrorists to blow up the World Trade Center. And I was like calling the phones weren't working. And I was trying to call my ex-girlfriend to tell her not to go out because I was afraid something else was going to happen. So again, all this human passion and drama against all this big, important human, you know. And that's really, I mean, we all love those movies where it's like this love story. In the background, the Japanese are bombing Pearl Harbor, but it's really about this couple, right? That's how my life felt. It felt like scary and out of control. And I took just a tiny little bit of that. And there was no internet. I had no internet connectivity. So I was actually blogging. I was writing my glamorous life with no connection and no idea when I would get a connection. The Inch.com, the company that hosted me, like their tower had been downtown and it had blown up. It had, like, nobody was killed, but so I had no idea if the internet was going to be there again. I had no idea if I was going to be able to go below 14th Street again. But I just wrote as this act of faith, and lo and behold, it became this thing. And for some people, that's how they experience September 11th. It's weird, but it sort of gave them a personal insight that they weren't getting from the kind of terrifying and sensationalist pictures that we were all looking at, right, on TV, or when we got TV again. This brings me to WASP. The Web Standards Project was another very weird cockamamie thing that was, I think, awesome, that shouldn't have happened at all and shouldn't have worked at all. But if you remember the browser wars, and we're sort of in the same time again now because it's, you know, now we've got iPhone versus Android, and, you know, there's 500 standard breakpoints on the Android platform, right? So we're sort of in the same place, although we have standards thinking to apply to it now. And we have brilliant people like Ethan Marcotte talking about responsive design. We have the folks at Future Friendly. If everyone's checked out that site, futurefriend.ly, because they don't have to be .coms anymore. I still like the .coms myself, but I'm old fashioned that way. So the Web Standards Project. The Web Standards Project was a sort of seemingly doomed attempt to get standards into browsers so that we could design them the same way from, you know, one browser to another. A bunch of us, I'm sure there are a lot of people in this room, Steve Champion, Dory Smith, Jeff Bean, Tim Bray, I'm not going to remember everyone, Glenn Olson. It started on a mailing list. It just started with people going, "This is crazy." It started when Netscape 4 and IE4 came out, and they were so different and so incompatible and had different scripting languages. And just some people on a mailing list going, "This is silly. We ought to do something about this." And then we talked about it almost like we were having a brain. It was a brainstorming session online. We said, well, if we called it the Web Standards Project, that could be the WASP. WASP would be good because, you know, WASPs are powerful when they get together as a group and they have a stinger. They're small, like the developers who are getting screwed right now are small. But if you get enough of them together, watch out. So we had that thinking, and we succeeded in getting browser makers to get on board. I think Tantek Celik is here, and he was one of the first browser engineers to do that. So we owe him a great deal of thanks. And he was working on IE at the time, IE for the Macintosh. But the other thing we did, we couldn't have done anything as ourselves, but it was all about reaching out to a lot of other people and getting them on board. So the Web Standards Project succeeded not because of any power that any of us had. We were pretty powerless, but it succeeded because we would, you know, if you were standing at a meetup in front of 100 people, you'd say, could you guys sign this petition? And then you'd have 100 more names on that petition, or 50 more, if 50 people did it. And it also, I became sort of a lawyer. That doesn't sound very good, but people would say, do you know how much money I make knowing the four ways to code a website? And I had to have an answer to that. And I'd say, but imagine if you could take that same budget and hire a photographer and hire a copy editor, right? What if you could spend the client's money developing features? Instead of having two features and coding them four ways, what if the site had eight features coded one way? Wouldn't that be nice? So this stood me in good stead when I became a professional web designer, because I was able to address client concerns in sort of a tactful way. I remember there's a guy named Dave, I won't say his last name, he invented RSS. It rhymes with finer. Dave rhymes with finer, who invented RSS. Does anyone know that guy? I remember being really resentful because he said, the reason Zeldman and his friends want everyone to use CSS is so they can charge high prices for their services, which I hadn't thought of. Actually, he turned out to be right. It just took me 10 years to, like, it took 10 years for what he said to come true. You know, now it's true. But then it wasn't. I was giving it away, you know. We're all giving it away. We design stuff for Google almost for free just when Google bought Blogger, just so that there would be millions of standards-compliant templates out there, right? Okay. My motivation for starting A List Apart, again, rage, resentment, fear. It was just a desire to read the kind of magazine that I wanted to read that nobody was making. There's a guy named Brian Platts, and he and I started a mailing list because has anyone been designing for websites since the 90s and remember mailing lists? It's okay, you're among friends. And also, like, you could still be just in your 20s, because a lot of people started real young. So it's okay, you could say that, and we know you're 29. But there were a lot of mailing lists, and they were, what happened on mailing lists to me was that there would always be a couple of domineering personalities that would take over, right, and kind of control the conversation, be kind of bullying. So I wanted to find some way around that, but I didn't know how. And what Brian Platts and I cooked up was a curated mailing list where you didn't read the mail that people were sending in. Everyone sent in their comments, and at the end of the day, Brian or I would edit it and come out with this curated magazine-like newsletter presentation. So we basically, I guess we were doing user-created content in 1997. That's kind of cool. How come I didn't think of Facebook? But anyway, we decided to make a website too, and I decided to take over. I would do the website, he'd do the mailing list, and then we lost the mailing list because of someone's company got bought, and there's a little long story I'm not going to get into. Like, I basically, whenever I hear anybody selling anything on the web, I always feel bad because so many of those experiences have been bad. People lost control of a good product, laid off a bunch of people, and the product sucked afterwards. It has been my experience. So, and that's what happened. That's what killed our mailing list. We didn't sell it. Someone else sold the server it was on, basically. Anyway, the magazine has evolved again because the community did so much for it. But the magazine was about, there were two magazines at the time. There was High Five, which was very designy, a magazine by David Siegel. Christopher Schmidt worked on it. It was a really good magazine. But for my taste, it was so design focused. It didn't address developers or UX, which we weren't calling that then, but it didn't address the content. It seemed like it was a great design magazine, but it didn't address development and content. And I felt the magazine should do that. And the other magazine was WebMonkey. Does anyone remember WebMonkey? And WebMonkey was super cool, but it was all code. And again, I thought, this is great. So just out of a motivation to do something that I wanted to read, I started A List Apart, and I basically went to my friends who I thought were talented and said, like Lance Arthur, Derek Pwazik, Heather Champ, Steve Champion, and I said, could you guys write an article? I can't pay you. And they said yes, because that's what people did on the web, still do. There's still, that's what we still do. That's making awesomeness on the web. People still do this. So, and because we had this, because we have this magazine and now we have this large readership, we're able to give back to the community and do things like the web design survey, where we try to figure out there were other surveys before this, like how much, there were surveys about do you use Dreamweaver or BBEdit. There's surveys like that. But no one had done a survey on what do you earn? What's your title? What's your educational background? And then tried to crunch the numbers and see, are there more men than women in a particular job title? What educational track leads to what job? Is there a correlation between a title like webmaster and a kind of company or organization? We were trying to create a picture, and we can't, again, my theme through all this is we can't do anything. It's all the community. But if you have, if you ask 36,000 people, do you feel like your age has been a factor in your work and has been a negative or a positive? Have people been, you know, has your sex been a problem? I don't mean how often you get it, but have people had a prejudice for or against you because of your sex and stuff like that? And then, you know, we were able to slice and dice the numbers and find out, and we found out really interesting stuff, like, and I still don't know what to make of it, but like, I have theories, but I'll keep them to myself. Like, women who think there's bias against women tended to have really good jobs and salaries. And women who don't think there's any bias against women tended to have crummy jobs and crummy salaries. It makes sense, but I can't, either can't explain why or I don't want to. And I started Happy Cog in 1999 because I walked out of a really good job there where I was being paid very well because I felt creatively frustrated and like I could do a better job. I could do a better job with clients. I could do a better job picking projects. And I've often said to anybody, like, if you're unhappy and if you're in client services and you're unhappy, try freelancing and try going out on your own and try starting a studio with a couple of friends. It really works. There's no shortage of work now for people like us. This is the part of the economy that's doing very well. And everybody focuses on, I mean, everybody focuses on, you know, some of the talks that have been here about, you know, amazing products people make that are valued at billions of dollars, amazing platforms that are valued at billions of dollars. That's cool. That's great. But there's another economic success story that not many people talk about, which is web designers, developers, UX people, content strategists, we're busy. We're making stuff, and it's the part of the economy that's working. And, you know, when I think about when Leslie was telling me about the kids, one of my first thoughts was, I wonder if those kids could learn HTML, some of them. Because whether you know, even if you didn't graduate high school, can you learn HTML? Can you grasp the principles of that? Or can, you know, there, it seems like a way out, right? I mean, there's sports and there's music and there's being a movie star. That's one way out of poverty. Not many people are going to get that, but HTML could be another way. And by HTML, I mean all the stuff that all of us do. Anyway, this is an early version of Happy Cog. This is my design for Happy Cog, followed by Jason Santa Maria's design for Happy Cog, which we lived with for like 8 years because it was really nice and we got so busy we couldn't redesign our own site in classic form. And a couple of weeks ago, we redesigned our site in a week, which was a really cool project that we have written about. I have two really wonderful partners, Greg Hoy and Greg Story. We opened a studio in Austin, which Greg Story runs. And this really started, and please enjoy the visual, ladies. This really started with me in my underwear, sitting at my desk, smoking cigarettes, which I used to do back then. I would roll out of bed, light a cigarette, and just start coding. And now we have this empire, which is amazing. Because if you believe, if you are motivated and you believe, you can do good stuff for people, and your work is worth, has value, you can actually make a company. Especially in our business anyway. And so I'm very happy about that. I feel like I'm, I don't want to say that all this stuff that I've done is awesome because I'm awesome, because that's not the truth. it's all awesome because it appealed to the community on some level. And it's awesome because I had the right motivation and was able to do the work to bring it to fruition. Eric Meyer and I used to talk. We talked at South By. We talked at lots of places. We're old and we've been talking for years. So, and I used to go like to Web Design World and watch the way, has anyone ever been to Web Design World? Okay. And Jim Hyde used to run that conference and he did a really good job of curating the content. There was a rhythm to who spoke and when, and when they broke into other sessions. And I watched and I learned. And Eric and I used to come every year and go, you know, we could do that. We'd be speaking somewhere and we'd be the two best speakers. Not that we're that great, but we'd be the two best speakers. And we think, you know who's better than us and who should really be on this stage? And I like this topic, but you know who I think would be good at, for this? And every year we would go to the place that's gone now. The gringo name was Avenue Cafe, and the Mexican name was the Sacred Bleeding Heart of Mary will live forever in our hearts. You know the place I'm talking about? What's the name? Los Panitos? Las Manitas, the place where you'd walk through the kitchen and eat in the backyard with chickens. It was the best food I ever ate anywhere. Eric and I used to go there every year, have a breakfast, and go, man, we should start a conference. And so one year we did. And when we started, it was really totally like, not Shirley Temple, but the Andy Hardy movies. Hey, kids, Mickey Rooney. That's it. Andy Rooney, Mickey Rooney. Thank you. I follow these like Alzheimer's trails to they're breadcrumbs back to what I was trying to say. Thank you. Yeah. Mickey Rooney. Yeah, and Judy Garland. Thank you. Very nice. Okay. Well, there's a retirement community meeting right after this. We can talk about. But anyway, the mom would sew the costumes, that's right, and the dad would build the sets, and it was like that. We did our first show for like 60 people in a Philadelphia museum, in like the back of the Don't Touch Museum. No, it was the Ben Franklin Museum, and our friend Ian Corey brought his microphones, and we had like a slide projector, like Don Draper's slide project screen, and it was just really basic stuff. And now we, it's not as big as this. Nothing's as big as this. We don't want it as big as this. It's a nice size for us. It's not the biggest, but we like it. And it just came from like just working at it and constantly going, who's a good speaker? That was good. Watching each speaker and going, they're communicating with the audience. They're not communicating. They have something important to say. They don't. And just, you know, basically like making playlists out of human beings. That's how I think of it, which is probably really disturbing, but I thought I would share that anyway. Okay, so then there's this. This is Hitler Rises from the Grave, which I'm sure you've all seen. No offense, Michael Nolan is here. Michael Nolan is the editor at New Writers who persuaded me to write this book. So tell him you're welcome, or thank you. Michael came to me in like 2002 and said, you got to write a book about web standards. I said, everybody knows mine. It's done. We're done with that. The browser wars are over. It's all done. He said, no, it's really not. I said, everybody knows. And he said, no, everybody does. Now it's been like, there have been like a billion copies sold and it's like 57 languages. And they assure me that I'm going to get a check soon. And it's really nice. But so for the first cover, I had taken a picture of myself with the flu using my ex-girlfriend's crappy digital camera with like, you know, it was like 1 megapixel or half a megapixel. And I was wearing this cap and I had used it on the web as a little animated thing that when you hovered near the footer of my website, my little cap would come up and like peek over the side, right? It was the 90s. It was like an early JavaScript thing for me, right? Hey, like this little animated GIF would be called into action when you moused over. And so that was my brand if I had one. And we tried really hard to come up with a book cover that would explain the concept of web standards. And I don't know, we had like telephone operators and and abacuses, and I don't even remember all. And we went through like every, and so basically I said, I have a great idea for the cover, me. And he said, well, how much? I said, Bean has it. Hillman Curtis has it. I want it. I want my face on the cover. He said, okay, well, we'll get a really good photographer. He said, no, we're going to use this picture from the website. But the picture was like, you know, low res, crappy, typical web crap. And so Michael said, we can't use it. We're going to have to reshoot it. We'll get a real shooter. We'll spend some money. He was dreaming, of course, because he's in publishing. They don't have any money. But he said, we'll spend some money. We'll get a real shooter. We'll recreate that shot, but on film. I said, no, it won't have the same feeling. Plus, I'm older and have more gray hair. I know what we'll do. We'll pixelate. And I pixelated it in Photoshop, and I said, here you go, it's pixelated. And this is how we can use this crappy low-res image and have it seem conceptual, like, oh, it's pixelated because it's the web. I get it. So the customer will buy the book thinking, wow, this speaks to me. I'm a web person, and I get what a pixelated image is. So what they did, I gave them the artwork, but they thought of it as like a rough demo, and they hired their person who did this totally, like, I don't know. It's just red-eyed, horrifying. I don't know how this book sold. And this book sold in China with this picture. Actually, in China, they replaced it with a dragon, yes, which was more appealing. So for the next one, I did the artwork, and you can see how I smoothed out my complexion. Right? Check that out.
Nice.
Photoshop. Adobe is a sponsor of this event, by the way. And we like Adobe. And yeah, same photo. Isn't that awesome? And then for the third edition, Lou, so I'm trying to think what color the fourth edition will be. We've been secretly patterning the books for A Book Apart on the colors of Designing with Web Standards. So now I'm afraid I'm going to have a yellow cover. Well, I can't do that because, anyway, it's complicated. And the last thing I want to talk about briefly, I got into the publishing business kicking and screaming a couple of years ago. Aaron Kassane, who'd been the editor of A List Apart for 10 years before Krista Stevens, had always wanted us to do these little books. And I had this long, I would just say, no, we're not going to do that. She worked at Happy Cog, and she was really brilliant. She is really brilliant. I don't know if any of you saw her at the content strategy session with Christina Halverson. Really brilliant person, but... I said, you know, we don't want to get into publishing now. The publishers can't make a living, and they've been doing it for a while. If they're struggling, why would we get into it? It's crazy. No. I said, we're in the Internet. The Internet makes money. We're going to keep doing the Internet. But every year she kept talking and fine-tuning the idea and telling me how brilliant it was. So I finally agreed, and I hired Jeremy Keefe, and then she quit. So she's not part of it, which is sad, but she gave birth to it, I think, which is awesome. But this is just, it's a really simple concept of very short books on very simple, not simple, on complicated topics, but just enough information, almost like a brochure, a pamphlet. And they're books that would be hard to, if we were using Amazon and if we were trying to get them in bookstores and if we had all that overhead, it would be very hard for us to justify making these short books. You probably couldn't make a living with them. So we sell them directly, which seems to work okay. And this doesn't mean that we're out of traditional publishing at all, because I think both kinds of publishing are needed. I just think there's an opportunity to do a new kind of publishing as well, if you have an audience and you sell direct. So that's that. And I want to go to your questions, but I just want to leave you with these wonderful motivating things. And if you can relate to any of them, I mean, helpfulness, if you're a helpful, if you're kind of a Pollyanna person.
I'm not Pollyanna.
I didn't do that.
Give me a break.
If you're a really sweet person, I'm looking over here, that can work for you, and kindness. Or maybe you're just obstinate. Maybe you're just stubborn, and you believe that you're, whatever you believe, you can do it. It's awesome. And now we want to look at Twitter and go to your questions.
I've been, well, let's first give Jeffrey a round of applause. I think his presentation reminds us why he's being inducted. What day is that? Is that tomorrow? Next day? Tuesday? Someday?
Tuesday.
So I think it really does show kind of the history of the web, at least through Jeffrey's contributions. So I've been asked, I think there's a microphone coming someplace. I don't know if that's true, but if there is, I've been asked for you all to line up in one place and ask questions. But since there doesn't seem to be one...
Is there a mic?
Is there a mic? There it is. Okay.
There it is.
So if anybody has a question that you'd like to ask with your actual talking voice versus Twitter voice, please come see this wonderful South by Southwest volunteer with a microphone. And if you have questions on Twitter, we'll take those as well.
Hi, John DeVoy from Arizona State University. I have a question about, this is maybe quite a dream, but since cross-browser compatibility is such an issue and so much time is wasted trying to get designs to work cross-browser, has there been any talk about Mozilla or IE picking up WebKit? I realize there's other problems there with, Chrome and Safari both kind of introducing custom elements and that type of thing, but...
So there's a couple of things that you're asking. I think what you're asking is... Tantik, who's here, and can explain for himself, works at Firefox and introduced the idea that the Mozilla browser would support certain WebKit properties or would... which already does support those properties, would support the WebKit vendor prefix because people were writing just for WebKit, even though Firefox supported the same stuff. This understandably has some people very upset because, well, if you're writing a vendor prefix for a specific browser and a different browser supports it, that's complicated. But so that's what's being done. That's what's being discussed being done. And on a larger scale, what you're asking is, will this stuff become standard? And yes, that's the idea, that the browser makers are introducing things like WebKit introduces something like a particular kind of shading or gradient, and if enough people like it, and it becomes part of the CSS3 specification. One of the really nice things about CSS3 is that it's modular, so bits and pieces get approved at a time, it's not some big monolithic standard that by the time it's approved, the browsers have moved on and it doesn't mean anything. It's a very modular standard, which is great, except it means they can keep tinkering with it forever. So that part's kind of... Thank you.
Thank you.
We have a Twitter question from Glenda Sims at Goodwitch, and she said, how do you refill your tank to make awesomeness after it has been drained by a super bad experience? Yeah, that's a really good question. Anybody have a challenge with that, feeling completely drained after something terrible happens? Yeah, I think we've been talking about it today. It's something that all of us handle differently. Sometimes it's really nice to make sure that you remember that a super bad experience will happen and that you can get through it. And to have colleagues and friends and people that are in your support system. And if that's over Twitter or email or in person, somebody you can call on and help kind of fill your cup with you. Other options are eating chocolate. That always works for me. Yeah.
You've got to develop a thick skin and not take stuff personally. You got to know that failure is part of learning for me. And here's what really happens. I try to think of everything like I'm in the gym and like, well, I can't really lift that yet, but I'm getting better and I'm going to be able to lift that soon. And it's hard and my body's tired, but I'm going to go at it. And then at night I have nightmares when I'm asleep where my unconscious, which is much less rational. So during the day, I have all these pep talk things that I can do. Like, I don't really care what people think. What other people think is not my business. If they don't believe in it, that's okay. As long as I believe in it, I will, all that stuff, all that rational daylight stuff, and then at night I cry.
We're like exactly the same like this. We discovered this today. I've been waking up just screaming and I have no idea why except I do. But during the day, it's like everything's great, and then at night it's boom, boom, boom. So I would say find a way to stress relieve in the day, if that's going to the gym or something else, or doing something creative or connecting and making you feel like you're doing something positive for the world. That helps too. especially with the nightmares and the night terrors.
And spend time with friends, spend time with your family, recharge from those good sources. Yeah. So you don't make, some people get like bent out of shape over a Twitter fight, right? And it's not real. At the end of the day, if somebody in another part of the world thinks you're a jackass, they might even be right, you know?
It happens. And then ask yourself, does it matter a year from now? I think that's a good question to keep perspective. I see other questions on Twitter. There's a lot coming in. Does anybody else have one that you want to get up to the mic and ask? So many to go through. If you had to start an agency again today, what would you do differently while still making awesomeness?
Wow. I'm really happy with Happy Cog, so I can't say that I would do anything differently. I would start small, I think you start small. You start as small as you possibly can. Did anyone go to see Dennis Crowley, Dens, the founder of Foursquare? Yes, it was great. And like one of the things he said that really I couldn't stop thinking about was he and Naveen, one other person, started Foursquare, and now they're 100 people. And part of you kind of longs for when I think about that, I always go, I bet it was really fun when it was just two people. I mean, the more successful you get and the bigger you get, there's wonderful opportunities you didn't have before, but there's also you lose something. So at Happy Cog, we're trying to stay a boutique. You know, we want to do Harvard Edu and all that stuff, and we do, but how can you do that and still stay a boutique? And I think, everybody faces that. I mean, South by Southwest, I think they have to be facing, like, how big can we get and still be South by Southwest? And every year, the conference is sort of an answer to that challenge. Like, whatever you take away that's great from South by Southwest is their answer to that question of how big can they get and still be what they were when it was 100 geeks.
It's sometimes hard to make awesomeness scale.
That's true, too.
This is a great question. You can ask, and then we'll ask this one, and then... Yeah, you with the red.
Red shirt, sir.
Stand up, though. Own your question, man.
Yeah.
So let's repeat the...
So the question was, is cynicism the enemy of making awesomeness? And I would say the answer is yes. The question was, any emotion, theoretically, according to what I said, can help you. But I agree with you. Cynicism will not help you at all. Cynicism, low self-esteem, doubting your self-worth. This is a stupid project. Why am I even doing it? No one's going to believe in it anyway. You have to be kind of naive and believe that you can make a difference.
And talk yourself into that. Fake it till you make it. Whatever you need. The words, because the words that we say to ourselves and to our friends, the things that we write, they're all what create our story. And if we're constantly saying negative things, then our story becomes negative. And so it's just about framing it. And it might sound Pollyanna, and people have said that about me. I'll tell you, I'm one of the most pragmatic people. I'm like super logical. I put on my Vulcan ears, two at a time. But it's sometimes important to just believe in something, and then you can take huge risk. And if you have set it up so your friends and family and support system are there with you believing, it's a better chance of success, and that's sort of awesome. I think we have, let's ask one more question, and then we'll be around a little bit, or you can find us on Twitter, but we want to make sure you have time to go out and have a good time at South By. This one's from Sam, who says, how do you teach awesomeness? Is it something you can teach? And I think I'm going to speak to that, but you can speak to it with an organization and a team in a different way. I think you can. My students, I say, go forth and make awesomeness on such a regular basis that they don't actually let me leave the room until I say it, which becomes awkward sometimes, because sometimes I don't feel as awesome as other times, but I'm like, go forth and make awesomeness, and then everyone can leave. And I think it's just all of us taking our energy and our passion and sharing that. If it's in a business environment, organization environment, and with our students, we can all share and teach awesomeness. It's about bringing energy and passion and context to and connecting people together.
And I would say, I said kind of half-jokingly that I kept saying, oh, I can do better. And that's okay, but another thing to say is just, I can do that. Inspire okay. people to know that they can do that. So if you say, oh, you know, I'm freelancing. By the way, you're really talented. I'm sure you could do that too. And if you constantly yeah. give tips and advice to people, not like quit your job, I never tell anybody that, but just like help them line up some freelance work in case the economy goes bad or in case they're in trouble. I think example, I watch other people. I wrote a book because I really, really loved David Siegel's book and Linda Wyman's books. And I wanted to, you know, I was stupid enough to think I could do that too. And, you know, for me, I used to draw these comics. I had this character called Rick Purvis, who was a detective. And I would show them to my mom, and she'd say, they're better than Superman, right? And isn't that sweet? And, like, all kinds of other stuff went wrong when I was growing up, but that one thing, my mom thought my comics were better than Superman. This is ridiculous. Superman's much better. But and that's not the point. The point was I had some faith in myself creatively, you know, in that way. I know that I can remember being really scared to do baseball and stuff. I remember feeling incompetent in gym and as a result being unathletic because I thought I was unathletic. And I can remember succeeding in art class because I thought I was artistic. And I'm not that artistic and I'm not that athletic and I'm not that unathletic, I'm not that unartistic. A lot of it is just what you believe about yourself. Inspire, I think, tell people when they do a good job. We forget to do that. We tell people when they work for us, that was late or whatever, but we forget to tell them that's awesome. I also seem like kind of a Pollyanna because I'm always telling people, you know, that's great. I really love this. I love this article. That's a fantastic illustration. How did you get that idea? And I'm sincere. I mean it. It's like people's creativity blows me away. It's wonderful. And I think if you keep on giving that out, people believe in themselves too.
And then everything rises up.
Everything rises up.
And then there's awesomeness that is made.
And then awesomeness is made.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.